It's a leap year, that year every 4 years when February 29 exists. I grew up always remembering leap years because the Olympics were on. And again, this year, the Olympics were there. Where the best of the world come and compete. But leap years also align with another event that I've become a little bit more aware of late. It's also the year when the US presidential elections happen. Every 4 years, same as the leap year. And it really is a year-long event. Some people, maybe you, get right into the presidential campaigns. And I can understand that. They're sort of fascinating and lengthy nomination processes. There's this sort of deep analysis of these key swing states. There's often novel and innovative campaign slogans. They're sort of digging up dirt and exposing flaws of potential candidate. And then there's the debates. These are often built up as the key event where policies are outlaid, where promises are made, and most recently, where a candidate's suitability is exposed. And so throughout the campaign trail, as voters listen, they consider to these candidates, they consider the candidates, you know, do I like this person? Can I trust what they're saying? And really, elections come down to a question of, who can you really believe? And now, ideally, it should be a decision about who will do the best job, shouldn't it? But so often, we vote out of self-interest. Who is going to deliver the best outcome for me? It's a decision that we make, not every 3 or 4 years when elections turn around. It's something that we hear governments each year sort of try and tingle our ears with. You know, how did you fare in this year's budget? You know, politicians, business people, health professionals or environmental advocates, they know that people tend to look after number one. That for humanity, self-interest often drives behaviour. We see it all the time. I saw it this week. I was hearing about the blood shortage in Australia, and then sure enough on my news feed, this ad came up from the blood bank encouraging me to donate blood. But the messaging was, you can get a free sugary treat if you just donate blood. And it's interesting, they're sort of trying to tap into this self-interest to drive behaviour. And it's strange because I think few of us are sort of anti-donating blood, but few of us actually do it. And for me, it's just, oh, I forget, it just feels like another thing on the list of multitude of good things that I could do. But the blood bank in this ad is sort of trying to tap into this idea that self-interest, it drives your behaviour. You can get a free, sugary, sweet treat if you just donate some blood. If we keep thinking about the elections, perhaps it's the politicians themselves who are motivated for a range of reasons to run for office. Perhaps their convictions on the greater needs of society. Perhaps they see the true value in serving the public. Or a personal belief that they can make a change. But surely in putting yourself out there, there's some self-interest too. A desire for the power, for the status, or the perks that come along with election. Another thing that you tend to hear during election campaigns is, what is going to be the key issues that decide the result? If there's an election today, it would obviously be cost of living as the main issue. In elections past in Australia, it's been about border security or the GST. And often politicians state boldly that this election is based on this issue. If I'm victorious, it shows that I've got a mandate from the people that validates me bringing about this change. Well, what am I jibbering on about politics for when we're in John 7? Well, it's not that I'm really interested in politics. Confession number two, I've never watched an episode of West Wing. I know that I'm maybe not even Christian because lots of my Christian friends love that show. But when I was listening to John 7 earlier this week, just on the audio Bible through a few different translations, I'm just like, this just sounds like question time in Parliament. There's speeches, there's questions, there's debate, and there's this core issue in Jesus' ministry, whether or not he's the Messiah. Is Jesus the chosen king? Is he the one who's sent from God to save and restore his people? Is Jesus the one whom hope can be found on and God's promises realized. At some level, as we've been tracing Jesus' ministry through John's gospel, he is on somewhat of a campaign trail, although his approach is so unconventional to what we normally see. There's no Jesus counting the numbers. There's no Jesus targeting swing voters. He's not content just to get the majority of people on side. We've heard Jesus' words. He's got a message for everyone. He's calling whoever to listen and believe. And rather than having his own political advisors or support team, rather than being driven by self-interest, we hear constantly again and we see manifest in his behaviour that Jesus has one allegiance, his Heavenly Father. He's only interested in one voice that will shape his behaviour. It's his Father's interest that shape what he teaches. He's not living a life trusting in self, but in his Father to deliver the results. And we heard it last week in John chapter 6, verse 37. All those the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never drive away. But just like any election brings about divided responses, so too Jesus' arrival and campaign is no different. John has been clear, and we see it so clearly in chapter 7, that Jesus divides. In meeting Jesus, people are meeting God himself. Earlier in John's gospel, in the prologue, John describes it that God has made his dwelling among us. That in Jesus, God has become visible. But meeting God divides. So some people meet God with uncertainty. Others interact with Jesus with suspicion, and many with downright opposition. But ultimately what we see here in John chapter 7 and what we know of life itself is that people have to decide. You're either going to meet Jesus in unbelief or you're going to meet him with belief. Back in the prologue in John chapter 1 verse 10, we read that Jesus was in the world, and though the world was made through him, it didn't recognize him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. What we're going to see in chapter 7 is that some people recognize Jesus whilst others remain unsure. Some will accept him while others remain highly suspicious. Some will see Jesus clearly and then others are still confused. Some will continue to pursue and seek Jesus while others will stand back and ridicule. All of these responses all concentrated in one scene. And the location of John chapter 7 is Jerusalem. It's in the temple and it's during the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Tents. Tabernacles was one of the major Jewish festivals, as Heidi outlined before. It was sort of normally at the end of olive and grape harvest. It was a time for the people to celebrate, to remember God's gracious provision, a festival of food and wine and people living in tents, pitching a tent for a week. It was a camping trip, though, with symbolism. It was to remind them of that time in the past when their ancestors who were rescued from Egypt and slavery traveled with God in their midst. The traveling tent, the tabernacle. The tabernacle that was a temporary structure that then generations later became the permanent construction, the temple, the centerpiece of God's people in God's land. With the preciousness of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that God's people were recognized as those whose God dwelt with them. And so now, in this annual festival, Jesus is going to reveal the privilege of what it is to meet him. But as always, the response to Jesus is divided. On the one hand, there's going to be uncertainty, suspicion, and opposition that ultimately culminates in a posture of unbelief. And on the other hand, we're going to see those who meet Jesus with belief. But firstly, have a look there at verse 5. His own brothers, they're trying to sort of navigate the campaign trail along with Jesus, trying to teach their older brother a thing or two. They're like, Jesus, you need to raise your profile if we're going to get this result. Stop going under the radar. It's time to put yourself out there. But again, we see that Jesus isn't driven by human influence or worldly strategies. Jesus is clear that this isn't his time. You see, he's not allowing self-interest to drive his behavior. He's more concerned with his Father's interests. And so we see here that even Jesus' own brothers are meeting him with unbelief at this time. And Jesus, not driven by the influence of his brothers, he waits and then makes a fashionably late appearance. But it's not sort of that late appearance with the grandeur where you're sort of teed up with the paparazzi to get the good shot. Now we see in verse 10, Jesus arrives in secrecy. But the word about Jesus is building. And so we see another response to meeting Jesus from verse 11. It's the Jewish religious leaders, and they meet him with a deep suspicion. Where is he? They ask. We've got to monitor him. We don't want to be caught out by him. And in fact, if we monitor him, we might catch him out. We might be able to trip him up. It's a bit like a new candidate who runs for parliament but has got a high profile before they come into it. You think of maybe Clive Palmer or Peter Garrett or Malcolm Turnbull in the past. Someone with a reputation that precedes them, there's suspicion amongst the incumbent about what they're going to bring. And so the Jewish religious leaders see Jesus and they're very suspicious. But the range of responses continues. It's not just unbelief. It's not just suspicion. We also see uncertainty. Have a look there at verse 12. Some in the crowd think, yeah, Jesus, he's a good bloke. Whereas others, they're adamant that he's deceptive. The crowd as a whole seem uncertain and they're looking for guidance. They're looking for something to validate whether they should accept or reject Jesus. And they're wondering how the authorities view Jesus. Whilst they're being some fairly obvious positive energy towards Jesus, there are rumours of opposition from the establishment. But the crowd at large sort of can't reconcile the rumours versus the lack of action. Have a look there at verse 25. Isn't this the man they're trying to kill? But here he is, speaking publicly, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Messiah? But we know where this man is from. When the Messiah comes, no one will know where he's from. There's uncertainty. They're trying to reconcile the rumours versus the activity. And again, the key issue is Jesus' identity. Is he the Messiah? Is God in their midst? And so, friends, meeting Jesus is always going to raise questions. And questions are scattered all throughout Jesus' ministry. But Jesus responds to these varying responses by exposing the heart of those he meets. Yes, some will meet him with uncertainty, others suspicion, some in direct opposition. But Jesus isn't really surprised by the divisions of responses. Have a look at verse 7. He sort of diagnoses what he expects to flow as people meet him. He says, "The world hates me because I testify that what it does is evil." It's because the world's evil that people meet Jesus with unbelief. And it's because Jesus speaks truly that he's hated. Now, we'll just give that a moment because it's a bit abrasive for our modern sensitivities, isn't it? Surely there's the odd evil person. But no, no. Jesus' presence in this world reveals the very heart of humanity. Jesus is like a crystal clear mirror that reflects perfectly what stands in front of him. No filters, no airbrushing, just natural clarity. And when you're in the face of Jesus, every wrinkle, spot, and blemish is there to see. And what Jesus reveals is that it's not just some individuals, it's not just Putin, it's not just Kim Jong, it's not just Hitler, but actually there's something in each of us that is trying to run our own campaign against the God of the universe. There's actually something that we all share in common about how we approach God in flesh. This campaign where we sort of feel qualified to sort of throw our hat in the ring, a campaign that we secretly hope we can win, or even quietly confident that we're the best candidate for. What is that campaign? Well, it's about the campaign is who's in charge of life? Who's ultimately in charge of the decisions that are before us? Who is in control of the priorities that shape our life? Who's in charge of this world and the way that we relate to one another and the way that we care and use the surroundings of this world that we live in? But functionally, we believe at some level that we're qualified to run life, don't we? To decide what's best for society at large, to deem what's appropriate way to relate to one another and what's right. But when we meet Jesus, he actually reflects back to us the very disrespect that we show in that posture, the naivety that we think we can just call the shots in our life, the delusion that we are in control of our life. And friends, Jesus calls it evil. A life that where self-interest shapes behavior, Jesus says, that's evil. And so when we're confronted with this reflection that Jesus gives back at us, it's not like sort of taking a selfie and like, ooh, better delete that before I post it. No. We can't just delete the reality of what Jesus exposes when we meet him. Because when we stand before Jesus, we stand before a human who lived by the paradigm of his Father's will and his Father's interest shaping behavior. It exposes our self-interest to shape our behavior paradigm. It exposes the ugliness of it. And if we're honest, there's a whole lot of ugliness that comes from this. Perhaps the double standards, you know, when we hold others to a certain standard, but that we easily overlook those same standards for ourselves. Or even over time, we become blind to the manifestations of that very behavior that we hate in other people, but is so evident in ourselves. Or when we stand before Jesus, the hypocrisy that we're willing to stand up for certain values publicly, but then overlook them through laziness or indulgence privately. Friends, to meet Jesus is a confronting experience for all of us. And so it's a no wonder there's a whole range of different responses. Uncertainty. Where do we really stand with this guy? Suspicion. What are his intentions for us? Is he able to deal with my mess? Or downright opposition? Offended. Hurt. Or maybe even just scared. When we confront Jesus face to face, it's pretty tempting just to smash that mirror and try and move on with life without him, isn't it? And that's sort of what we see from the Jewish religious leaders from chapter 7. They're trying to seize him. They want to arrest him. And ultimately we see that they are successful in killing him. Friends, when we meet Jesus, it just divides. I wonder whether you've ever wondered why some people meet Jesus with unbelief. Young people who have grown up in the church all their life, their parents have been a faithful witness, and then just sort of drift off into a life of unbelief. Why people who are in really hopeless and dark situations in life and hear the offer of forgiveness and grace are unwilling to receive it? Or people knowing that death is imminent, and even with the full faculties of their mind, they still meet Jesus with unbelief? Well, Jesus says that the confronting thing in meeting him is that this paradigm that our self-interest shaping our behaviour, it's exposed for all the evilness that it contains and all the unworthiness that it sets for us. And we're confronted when we look at Jesus in the purity of his life, the purity of someone who does stand up for truth. In Jesus, we see the value of what it means to uphold and defend justice. And in Jesus' life, we see the appropriateness of a life of obedience to the Father's will. Friends, meeting Jesus will divide. There's going to be uncertainty, suspicion. It's going to manifest unbelief. But on the other hand, look at verse 31. Still, many in the crowd believed in him. They said, when the Messiah comes, will he perform more signs than this man? People are meeting Jesus with belief. And why are they believing? Well, they're comparing Jesus' actions with the things that God's promised in the past. What would we expect if this Messiah that God had promised actually came? Well, we'd expect pretty much similar to what this guy is demonstrating before us. And so to meet Jesus with belief is almost to resign our campaign about who's in charge of life. At some level, it's a little bit like Joe Biden's recent resignation from the race, an admission of weakness. It's meeting Jesus and saying, yep, I'm inadequate to be in charge. But unlike Biden's situation, it's not just our weakness and our deficit, but ultimately it's because of the worthiness of the other, Jesus. And so despite our foolishness in trying to stand up against God, to run a campaign directly against him, have a look at verse 37 to see God's posture towards people who would do such wicked things. On the last day, last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood up and said in a loud voice, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as Scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them." By this he meant the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were later to receive. Jesus, he saved his memorable speech till the end of the festival, and he invites anyone who's needy, bringing together both the image that we got from chapter 4 of the water, the image in chapter 6 of the bread, the essential physical elements for life. He brings them together again to highlight our spiritual need and his concrete provision. And again, we see the very heart of God, unlike the politician who can sort of gloat in his failed opponent, who might sort of give a token acknowledgement of their existence, but deep down and in private conversation mocks and undermines and condemns their opponent. No. Jesus offers to give those who once opposed him the opportunity of not only a place in what he's establishing, but to have a role alongside him. A place where you have the privilege of God dwelling in your midst, and this role where streams of living water will flow from you. Friends, you see that when you meet Jesus with belief, what you receive, you not only have life, but you become the conduit for life to others. It's like a political opponent defeating someone at the election and then inviting them to be part of their party and then giving them a role in their cabinet. This is how radical the invitation from Jesus is. But friends, we need to remember this morning from John chapter 7 that meeting Jesus divides. Some will continue to meet him in unbelief, but those who meet him with belief move from trusting in number one to being looked after by the one who loves them. So where are you at today in meeting Jesus? Maybe you're undecided, uncertain, suspicious, or opposed. What are the issues that are going to decide the result for where you end up with Jesus? Now, unlike the crowd at that time, a few of us probably have a fully formed view of what the Messiah is and trying to match up whether Jesus fulfills it. But there's a good thing that we do regularly here is working our way through the Bible, including the Old Testament. And as we saw in Daniel in our last series, these promises from God, the Ancient of Days, the Son of Man, they're realized in Jesus. If you're uncertain, can I encourage you to keep investigating? Uncover Jesus for yourself. Perhaps the uncertainties about the reliability of the Bible. Perhaps you've got some uneasiness with the Christian sexual ethic. Perhaps you're just uncomfortable with Jesus' exclusive claims or doubts about his worthiness. Friends, continue to wrestle with any unbelief that is in your heart. And there'll be others who are suspicious of the church, people who have been hurt deeply or had unrealized expectations on God that he hasn't delivered for. The danger is that these things just left to swell can forge as a strong opposition towards God. And perhaps the biggest obstacle we all face is our own pride. The delusion in thinking that we match up pretty well with God, that we're doing okay at making good decisions with our life. Friends, if there's elements of unbelief that's in your reaction towards Jesus, the good news for you and for each of us is that God's posture is always inviting us to return to him in belief. And probably for most of us here, we've sort of made that switch in meeting Jesus with unbelief to a life where we're wanting to trust him. And we're reminded that trusting and believing in Jesus isn't just a once-off thing, but it's a daily event. Meeting Jesus with belief, it's not going to be easy because it's going to be challenged. And meeting Jesus with belief isn't just for a moment, but it's for a life. And so there'll be seasons that we wrestle with uncertainty. Perhaps there'll be elements of suspicion over God's character. If he is good, why would he allow us to walk through this darkness? But there'll be times when perhaps our emotions are actually opposed to what God says is good. We have desires that he says are not good for us to act out. And we'll have a real wrestle there. Friends, meeting Jesus with belief, it's not easy, but it's good. And over time, it can become more natural. Over time, as we continue to encounter uncertainty, our various suspicions or oppositions, as we remain committed to want to meet Jesus in belief, asking God to search us, to fill what is lacking, to soften those things that we sort of seem opposed to, as we try and live out that posture as Jesus guided us in prayer, not my will, but yours be done, then over time, as we stand in front of Jesus trying to meet him with belief, what he reflects back to us will start to change. It's not the change that you sort of see looking in the bathroom mirror each morning, but it's the change that you see in photos of yourself 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And it's not the physical change, but it's the maturing. It's looking back and seeing how you're more willing to allow the Father's will to shape your behavior rather than your will. It's looking back with joy at pursuing the Father's interests over your own. Over time, we'll look back and we'll see a more mature you. We'll look back on previous times in our life and look with, you know, a laugh and a despair at the foolishness and naivety of our outlook on life. But we'll thank God that there is change. You see, when we meet Jesus with belief, day in, day out, we are transformed. And it's not just a change that we can sort of see in our personal reflections with God. It's something that's visible around us. Because rivers of living water flow from you. And so over time, others will testify to the life that you've brought to them as you've translated your belief in Jesus into actions and relationships. Others will be able to testify how you've nourished them, how you've enriched them, and how you've blessed their lives. But again, meeting Jesus divides. And so not everyone will see it that way. Friends, some people will be threatened by you. Some people will be angered by you. Some people will be opposed to you because of your belief in Jesus. We shouldn't be surprised by that, nor should we be excited by it. Friends, we should be saddened. We should be prayerful. And we should be hopeful in knowing that no matter how uncertain or suspicious or opposed someone is towards Jesus, there's always the possibility for them to move. Move from meeting Jesus with unbelief and turning to him in belief and receiving that great promise that those who were once enemies, he will now call children. Let's take a moment to reflect on God's word for us.